All right, we are in Mark chapter 13. This is the outline that we are following. We are in the last section on the events at Jerusalem, where we are in the final week of the life of Christ, subdividing that a little further as per Stouffer's outline. We are in the section on teaching here in Jerusalem. As he has outlined it, there's the teaching section, then there is the trial, which we'll get into next time, his death, and then his resurrection. So in the final week, there is a period of teaching. He does some on Monday and on Tuesday primarily, and perhaps some on Wednesday. You know the question about that we flagged several times. We'll get to in Luke 21. Let's review our chapters of where we've been, and then we'll get underway with chapter 13. Chapter 1, what's it about? All right, the beginning of that Galilean ministry. Chapter 2. Conflict with the Pharisees gets started early in Mark's account. Chapter 3, part of that controversy. Over Sabbath healing. Chapter 4, parables. Chapter 5, three miracles. Chapter 6, parallel to Matthew 14. John is beheaded. Very good. And miracles. Then chapter 7. Yeah, here's the eating with unwashed hands. More of that controversy that is painted throughout. Chapter 8, Peter's confession. It seems that Mark is driving to that conclusion in the early part of the book, as we pointed out. Chapter 9, yeah, transfiguration and relationships. Very good. Chapter 10, Matthew 19, parallel. Divorce and remarriage. Chapter 11, that's where the triumphal entry into Jerusalem takes place, and beginning this Passion Week, or the final week in the life of Christ, which brings us then last week to chapter 12. Yeah, parable of the vine dressers, and there's an exchange of questions. A number of questions they ask him, trying to ensnare him, and then he asks them a question and put them to silence. All right, what's chapter 13 about? Question one for today. Yeah, the destruction of Jerusalem. Question two, parallel accounts. Where are they? Matthew 24 and Luke 21. Very good. So let's remember those accounts. We're not going to, as we have with other passages, take verses 1 through such and such and then look at all the parallel accounts. But we have two parallel accounts. John doesn't give us an account of this, but Luke does, and especially Matthew. We're all more familiar with Matthew 24, and so we'll play more to it than we will Luke, but we'll flag some things in Luke as we go along. All right, now we're in the last week of the life of Christ. You'll look at this and see this each time until we get through with Mark, because this is where we're focusing. And so if you are marking in the margin of your text what day we are in, where we are, we're on Tuesday of this week. So all of the events of chapter 13 is a discussion that took place on this Tuesday. Same day that he gave that scathing rebuke of Matthew 23. We saw a brief snippet of that here in Mark, but Matthew 23 is a more extended rebuke. All of that takes place right here on Tuesday. The trial picks up on Thursday, and that's where we're going to jump to. Perhaps Luke suggests there was more teaching on Wednesday, and we assume maybe there was. But we'll get to that in Luke and try to settle that question in Luke. All right, any questions about where we are in the text, where we are in the week? Still on Tuesday. In fact, the whole chapter is devoted to that. All right, let's get underway. Matthew chapter 13, or Mark chapter 13. This obviously, the whole chapter is devoted, we call it the destruction of Jerusalem, though there's more to the chapter than the destruction of Jerusalem. In fact, there are two issues, two questions that we'll get to here in just a second. Much similar to Matthew 24, Jesus makes an announcement that prompts some questions, plural, and then Jesus gives answers to those plural questions, meaning two different answers. Make sense? Same thing we saw in Matthew chapter 24. So We're going to look at this announcement first, verses 1 and 2, and we're going to then look at the questions, look at the parallel, and in Matthew 24, and then we're going to look at the answers, spend most of our time with the answers. As we talk about parallel accounts, and I know I mentioned here Mark, what I'm trying to flag for you is not the only thing that Mark mentions that's not mentioned in the parallel accounts, but if you're marking some things only in Mark or that kind of thing in the margin of your text, you might flag verse 3 because verse 3 adds some information that we didn't see in Matthew 24, which is that he was on the Mount of Olives opposite of the temple and tells us which disciples raised the questions. That makes sense? Matthew didn't tell us that. Mark is informing us of that. And so it was Peter, James, and Andrew asked him privately. There was apparently an announcement made in Jerusalem. They go out just a short ways to the Mount of Olives, sitting there. The disciples, okay, tell us, when will these things be and what's the sign of your coming, the end of the age? All right. Then verse 32, there is a point added here that you might underline, lest we not make it later, so you might jump ahead. Matthew had mentioned that of that day and hour knows no one, neither the not the angels, but only the Father. But Mark adds, nor the Son. Does that make sense? We didn't see that in Matthew. We don't see that in Luke. We only see that in Mark. So Mark gives us that piece of information. So who knows the time of his coming? Well, the angels don't know it. No man knows it. Neither the Son, but the Father knows. Make sense? All right. Let's see what we see in Luke. What does Luke add for us? Well, Luke adds the points of verse 11. There's some talks about the fearful sights. We didn't see that. It may be implied, but that's... Then Luke adds in verse 20 that when you see Jerusalem surrounded by the armies, that phrase wasn't mentioned in Matthew or in Mark. And then at verse 24, there's some information here about the Gentiles, Jerusalem being trampled by the Gentiles. Well, we know that's the case. We understood that from Matthew, but that's mentioned here in Luke. Does that make sense? Where we're getting a little more information from the parallel accounts? All right, let's go to the announcement. So they are in Jerusalem in the last week, and as he went out of the temple, he's been in the temple area, and as he comes out from that, what prompts a discussion here? Wasn't something Jesus said? Yeah, they're looking at the beauty of the temple compound area, the temple itself, and you see what manner of stones these buildings are. In other words, this is an impressive sight, to look at the buildings, to look at the stones, to look at the temple. And Jesus said to them, verse 2, what's his announcement? Wow, that's an amazing statement, isn't it? I mean, they're impressed with the buildings. Jesus makes an announcement, there's not one of these stones going to be left on top of the other. In other words, there's going to be utter destruction right here, including this temple, including this city. There's not going to be one stone left on top of one another right here in this city. That's not what they were expecting. That's not what they understood. That's like if you went to Washington, D.C., and you're looking and you're impressed with the White House and the Capitol building, and somebody that you recognize to be a prophet, and you really knew them to be a true prophet, that this is all about to be leveled. Would it raise an eyebrow? Would it raise any questions? Like, my first question would be, when? And that's what they ask. Make sense? That's the announcement, the utter destruction of Jerusalem. Now let's talk about the question, or questions, plural. And this is found in verses 3 and 4. What did they ask? Yeah, when will these be, and what will be the sign when all these things will be fulfilled? Well, that would be the question I would ask. You say it's going to be utter destruction. When is it all going to take place? Now, let's add some information that we have to have for the chapter to make sense. Matthew 24 tells us, if we only had Mark, and that's all we had, we didn't have Luke, we didn't have Matthew, we would get the impression the question was, when will the destruction of Jerusalem take place? Because that's what they ask at verse 3 and 4. I don't see anything about the end of time in Mark 13, do you? I'm talking about at verse 3 and 4. I don't see a thing there. Now follow me carefully. I think in the mind of the disciples, the destruction of Jerusalem equals the end of the world and the end of the age. That Jesus must be talking about the same thing. When the end of time comes, that's when all this... So when will this take place? I'm not really concerned whether they were confused over that. I am concerned about the clarity with which Jesus speaks. Does that make sense? You say, well, they thought it was the same thing. You're right about that. But Jesus didn't think they were the same thing. And he draws the distinction. So let's flag Matthew 24, verse 3. There were two questions that were asked. He sat on the Mount of Olives. The disciples, now Luke tells us who they were, or Matthew, the other accounts tell us who they were, came to him privately and they said, tell us, when will these things be? And what he just announced was the destruction of Jerusalem. So when will these things be? That's question number one. And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? They may have thought, and I think they did, that's equal, that's the same event. But that was actually a second question. Does that make sense? Because we know the destruction of Jerusalem took place in AD 70, but the end of time, the second coming, is yet to come. They are distinct events. But they may have thought it was the same thing. Am I making sense? All right. So let's. You may flag in the margin of your text that there are actually two questions, one about the destruction, one about the second coming and the end of the age. All right. Now with that in mind, let's go further and let's talk about the answers, because that's what the bulk of the chapter is about. So Jesus answers the question. He answers it twofold. In verses 5 through 30 is the destruction of Jerusalem. And then verses 31 to 37 has to do with the second coming or the end of the age. Jesus draws a distinction. There's going to be a transition point. We'll flag that when we get there. Are we making sense? Now what we have here, it's much like, I think part of the confusion of these chapters, like Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 21, is there's just a collection of verses, and it's much like if you made a long list of things you need to do before you go on a trip, and where you're going to go during your trip, things you hope to accomplish, and things you're going to need to do when you get back off of your trip, and you pull them all together, it's kind of a confusing list. What an outline does, which we're about to do, we're going to sort things out and put them in piles. In other words, we're going to take what takes place before the destruction of Jerusalem. Here are these that deal with the destruction of Jerusalem. Here's what's going to take place after the destruction of Jerusalem. Does that make sense? That's going to bring clarity to the text. Now, let's go back to a basic principle. Up and down, yes, back and forth, no. Does that make sense? There's another option. This means I'm confused. Would you start all over and go back to verse 1? Make sense? All right. Let's talk about the destruction of Jerusalem. Now, under that section of the destruction of Jerusalem, there are things that take place before the tribulation. There's the tribulation, after the tribulation, and then the specific question of when will this happen. Now, when we start separating all that out, the chapter becomes clear to me, and hopefully it will to you as well. So let's focus on before the tribulation. Now let's get ahead of ourselves. Let's fast forward what he refers to, and let's get ahead and jump over to verse, verse 13? The abomination of desolation, where he talks about this tribulation. He's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem and refers to Daniel 9. Now we'll get that passage to the specific verses in a moment. So before all of that takes place, verses 5 to 13. So let's talk about what takes place before the tribulation. Let's see what that is. All right, beginning at verse 5, what does he say? There are going to be false prophets. Take heed that no one deceive you. Here's a practical lesson. Let's get ahead of ourselves to question 10. We are responsible if someone deceives us. Would you agree with that? You say, well, now, whoa. They are responsible. They taught false doctrine. That's true. But I'm responsible for letting them deceive me. Jesus said, take heed that no one deceive you. And then he adds it, verse, for many will come in my name saying, I am he, and deceive many. Some are going to come saying they are the Messiah, and they're going to deceive and lead people astray. So before the tribulation comes, there's going to be false Christ. Some claiming to be the Messiah. All right, let's get verses 7 and 8. What else is going to take place before the tribulation? All right, there's going to be wars and rumors of wars. The Roman period of peace is going to come to an end. In AD 50, there was tension beginning to rise. There were Jewish wars from 65 to 72 AD. At Caesarea, there was 20,000 Jews died. At Alexandria in Egypt, 50,000 died. At Damascus, 10,000 died. And so all of that period of peace is going to come to an end. And by 65, the wars are going to take place, killing a bunch of Jews. And consequently, there's going to be wars. There's going to be rumors of wars. And when you hear all of that happening, don't get excited, I'm paraphrasing, because end of verse 6 or verse 7, the end is not yet. I mean, this is a sign that things are coming, and nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom, so there's going to be all kinds of wars. Now, let me stop here to say this passage is often used by premillennialists when war breaks out in the Mideast, oh, this is the sign of the end of time is coming. When we dropped bombs on the nuclear sites in Iran recently, what was that, a couple of months ago, 6 weeks ago, something like that? Oh, that's part of the war is about to break out in the Mideast. And when Israel and Hamas or the Palestinians are fighting, there's evidence. That has nothing to do with this text. Nothing to do with this text at all. All right, now the next thing that takes place is there's natural calamities, like what? Earthquakes, famines, and notice, you might circle or underline at the end of verse 8, these are the beginning of sorrows. The end is not yet. The beginning of sorrows and the end is not yet seem to be parallel to me. Here are some signs that things are rolling in that direction. This is all going to take place before the tribulation. Now, there's going to be persecution. We're going to look at three different verses. At verse 9, we see persecution. That he said there's going to be, lost my place, verse 9, that they'll watch out for yourselves. They'll deliver you up to councils. You'll be beaten in the synagogues. You'll be brought before rulers and kings for testimony. Verse 11, just drop down. What else do you see? They're going to, be delivered. You're going to be arrested. And don't worry about what you speak because the Holy Spirit's going to tell you what to say when you're under pressure. And that was to the apostles, not to all men. And then verse 13 is going to describe this persecution also, that you'll be hated for my name's sake and the one that endures to the end. So there's going to be persecution. Now let's pause for a moment. Two things we learn about persecution here. That the apostles would be inspired. They would be told how to answer and how to respond. Luke 21, 14 and 15 gives a little shade of deeper meaning there, perhaps. Matthew 10, not parallel account, but parallel in principle, verses 19 and 20. But here's a practical thing to answer to question 10. Verse 9 is telling me that when we're under pressure, we're liable to stumble. And that's the warning to the apostles. You may stumble. You're going to be under pressure in the midst of this preceding the tribulation. All right, let's go to verse 10. What else is going to take place before the destruction? The gospel is going to go to all nations, meaning it's going to go to the Gentiles. So as the gospel goes forth, it first goes to the Jews. So the gospel is going to go to the Gentiles. So you know the destruction of Jerusalem is not just yet when it's only gone to the Gentiles. I mean, only to the Jews. By the time it goes to Cornelius, now that's one of the signs that things are moving closer to the destruction of Jerusalem. The gospel did go to every creature under heaven, Colossians 1, 23. And then verse 12 says something else is going to take place. Yes. Family members give up family members. Go back to Matthew 24 for a moment, just as the parallel account to that. I think makes this point a little bit clearer to me, at least. Make sure I got the right verse. Matthew 24 and in verse 12, the love of many will wax cold. In other words, there's going to be sin all around. So corrupt and so sinful, families turning against families, all kinds of destruction of one another and families. So here's the point I want you to see. We can spend a lot of time talking about the details of the wars, but all of this takes place before the tribulation. Are we together? Tracking with me? So before this destruction of Jerusalem, here are some signs that lead up to that. This is not about the end of time. All right, let's go back a step in our outline. We've covered the before tribulation. Let's focus on the tribulation. All right, so let's go to, I thought I had a question on this. I don't see it. So I'll ask, where is the prophecy of the destruction of Jerusalem in the Old Testament that is alluded to here? Daniel chapter 9, verses 23 to 27, a difficult text. But what is not difficult about the text, all understand, when we talk about Daniel 70 weeks is what's difficult at times, what's not difficult is all understood, it pointed to an ultimate destruction of Jerusalem. So if you don't have marginal notes, flag, Daniel 9 is this abomination of desolation, the destruction of Jerusalem was prophesied in Daniel 9. So when the time finally comes, after all these signs are pointing, you're leading up to the destruction of Jerusalem, here is the destruction of Jerusalem, the tribulation. So let's see what happens. First, there's going to be the Roman army in the temple. So get the picture. When you see the abomination that was spoken of by Daniel, standing where it ought not. Well, this is Gentiles are going to enter into the temple. They didn't have a right to be in the temple. Not according to the law of Moses. They had no right to be there. Then let them understand and let those in Judea flee. So we'll come back to the fleeing. So they're going to see the Roman army, the Gentiles, entering into the temple. That's part of this bomb. That's the fulfillment of Daniel 9. So if you don't have an answer to question 10, here's you another practical thing. Prophecy being fulfilled gives us evidence. Finish the sentence. That the word is true. Daniel was speaking by inspiration. Fulfilled prophecy is always evidence that the prophet was inspired of God. All right, next, verses 14b through 18. What's he say for them to do? To flee. What does this mean? Get out of Jerusalem. The destruction is going to take place in Jerusalem, so get out. Now, you might make a marginal note so you can talk to your friends who are premillennialists. And if you have religious friends, I don't know the exact number, but I think it's safe to say 80 to 90% of them are premillennialists. Most likely, if you have someone in denominationalism, they believe in some form of millennialism. And they think that this is a discussion of the end of time. If this is talking about the second coming, how is fleeing going to help? It's not. So if this is talking about the end of time destruction, me take off running, I'm not going to get anywhere. And you're not either. This is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. So let's get verse 14. You flee to the mountains, that is, get away. The one on the housetop, this is how urgent this is. The one on the housetop is to, don't even go down into the house. If you're up on the roof of the house, flat top houses, where you might be engaged in resting or whatever, don't go down into the house to get something and you take off and leave. If you're in the field, don't go back to get your garment that you've taken off. Woe to those that are pregnant or nursing babies. Why is that? It'd be harder for them to flee. And pray that your flight be not in winter. Why? Yes, not prepared. It's more difficult to travel. Matthew mentions on the Sabbath. The Sabbath would be when businesses are closed, making fleeing more difficult, gathering supplies or whatever you need for traveling. And because so many Jews would be resting, if you're fleeing, you may be, the Christians may be the only ones that are moving on that day, makes them targets. So pray that it's not on the Sabbath, pray that it's not in winter, woe to those that are pregnant. So here's the idea of fleeing, getting away, getting out of there. And now beginning at verse 19, what does he say? 19 and 20. We're not talking about minor problems here for Jerusalem. What are we talking about? All right, utter destruction of the city. Nothing like it's been before and nothing like it be after. In fact, let's go back to verse 1 or verse 2. Jesus says it's going to be so utterly destructive that not one stone would be left on top of the other. That's pretty utter. Not that we're going to tear these buildings down. You can destroy a building and leave most of it standing, but there's not going to be one stone left up on top of another. There's another principle about this great tribulation. And if this wasn't true, no one would survive. What is it? What does that mean? Yeah, it didn't last forever. It doesn't go on for a long period of time. And so it's shortened in the sense that the time period, that it doesn't last forever. And there's a reason for that given in the text. What is it? For the elect's sake. That's God's people whom he has chosen. He shortened the days. His mercy for those that live righteous. His interest is in destroying and utterly destroying Judaism. From AD 70 forward, you've heard me say this many times, there is not a Jew from AD 70 beyond that can trace their lineage back to which tribe they're of. Now they can guess, say, I'm of the tribe of Judah. They can't prove it because all records were destroyed, utter destruction. Does that make sense? This was utter, complete destruction of Jerusalem. All right. Now that gets us down through verse 20. Now verses 21 to 23 says, during that tribulation, it was going to happen before verse 6, but it's also going to happen during this period of tribulation, however long that may last. And that is, there's going to be false Christ to arise. So he warns them, saying what? If someone comes to you, don't believe him. Someone's going to say in the middle of this, I tell you what, this is the coming of the Messiah. And he's over here. Let's go see him. Don't believe him. Oh, no, he's over there. Don't go see him. And he said, beware, I told you beforehand. When you've been warned beforehand, there's no excuse for falling for the deception. Now, in interest of time, let's move on. Now, we've covered the before tribulation, the tribulation. Let's talk about after the tribulation. And this gets us down through verse 27. To me, this is the most difficult section of the chapter. And so let's see what we can do with after the tribulation. It's part B, verses 26 and 27, that's more difficult, not in understanding, but which direction does this point? And we'll get to that here in a second. You might flag at verse 24, the word after. In those days after the tribulation, Matthew's account adds at verse 29, I think it is, this is immediately after, for what that may be worth to you. And it is worth something if you'll flag that. He talks about that the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, and the stars of heaven will fall, and the powers of heaven will be shaken. What on earth is that about? That's put very well. I appreciate the way you worded that. That is, it's an utter upheaval and change in order. So much so, it is not literally the sun will not shine, and you say, well, that's what it says. Well, this is deeply rooted in Old Testament language. So let me flag some passages for you. And you might want to write these in the margin of your text. You did in Matthew, perhaps. Let's do that here. Isaiah 13 talks about the fall of Babylon. And Babylon was described as the sun will be darkened as it go forth and moon will not shine, etc. And I'm not going to take time to develop all that, but the point is, Babylon was such a major empire that when it falls, it's like the sun doesn't shine and the moon doesn't shine and the stars have fallen out of heaven. All right, let me give you another passage. The same thing was said concerning Egypt, Ezekiel 32, verses 7 through 9. Similar language is used in Acts 2 and in verse 20. I'll give those passages again in case you missed those. It describes a change in order, a downfall of the nations. I'm going to illustrate that here in a second. But Ezekiel 32, 7 to 9, Isaiah 13, 10, and Acts 2 and in verse 20. All right, now let's picture this. Let's suppose you get up in the morning, turn your TV on, and there has been another nation, China, for example, let's say, has overpowered and taken our nation. There is no Washington, D.C. anymore. It's been utterly destroyed. None of our officials are living anymore. None of them. We have no one in charge. It's China that's in charge. And they have stationed military all across the nation controlling our country. And when you turn the news on and you get that, would you kind of be shaken a little bit? It's kind of like the sun quit shining. Kind of like the moon fell from the skies or the stars have all fallen. I mean, this is an utter shakeup of everything you know. And that's the way it was in the destruction of Jerusalem. It's an utter upheaval, as we see in Isaiah. Now let's... Right. True. Now let's go to verses 26 and 27. This is what's difficult for me is, and I've kind of gone back and forth, and I think the second idea that I'm going to present to you makes sense. It talks about the Son of Man coming in the clouds with great power and glory, and he'll gather the elect from the four corners of the earth. And let's take those verses and you lift them out away from Mark 13, and if you just read those, you say, well, that's talking about the second coming. And it may be. Some have suggested, and I've given consideration to that, that this may be saying, in contrast to what we've just been talking about, that the sign of the second coming will be the second coming. There is no sign. That may be what the emphasis is. Stouffer presents this view, and I think it's worthy, and I lean more in that direction in this text, though I've kind of leaned in the other direction at times. But nonetheless, that the context is still dealing with the destruction of Jerusalem. We haven't made the transition, which we're about to, and we've got to do that, or we're not going to do justice to the text. That this terminology was used in Isaiah 19 in verse 1 to talk about the change again in order. And the idea here is that God's using sends his angels. These are messengers. So even the Roman army is a messenger of God to bring destruction upon Jerusalem. And the idea of gathering up his people is rescuing them from the powers and the influence of Judaism. And that this is the coming of the Son of Man in judgment. Because we're still talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. Well, that makes sense because notice the next verse. He doesn't seem to change gears at all. Now, learn this parable of the fig tree. And so what's the point of the parable of the fig tree? Well, the parable of the fig tree we'll get to in just a second that you know from the signs that you see that things are about to take place. All right, now that's about the best I can do at this moment with 26 and 27. Let's talk about when all of this will happen. And this takes us 28 to 30. Now, verses 29 and 30, before I get to that slide right there, notice he said at verse 28, he gave this parable, but get verse 29. When you might circle. Also, when you see these things. So who's going to see these things just mentioned? Those that were listening, those that were then living, you know the door is near. Does that make sense? So it's going to take place, verse 30, in their lifetime. Notice he said, at verse 30, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass till all these things take place. So what we've been talking about, when's it going to take place? In your lifetime, before this generation dies. Doesn't mean somebody wouldn't die. It just means in the lifetime of this generation. There's going to be people now living, still alive when this takes place. So none of that are we waiting on. Now we need to flag this, and if we don't, we've missed it. Here's the key to the chapter. Here is the transition point. This generation will see these things take place. Assuredly, I say to this generation, will by no means pass till all these things take place. All that he's been talking about would take place in that generation. Now here's the transition point. Heaven and earth will pass away, and of that day, what day? When heaven and earth will pass away, no one knows, not even the Son, not the angel. Make sense? Remember, there were two questions. What were the two questions? When will these things, the destruction of Jerusalem, be? And sign of the coming of the Son of Man, the end of the age. Now he's ready to talk about that. Make sense? So if we don't have this transition point, we do injustice to the chapter. Make sure you got that transition point. Now we're ready for the destruction, the second coming. So we've got time to, in a couple of minutes, to finish this up. So what do we learn from verse 32 about the second coming and the end of the age? No one knows. There are no signs coming. So when someone says, I think this is a sign the end of time is about to come, there are no signs. If the Son doesn't even know, what makes you think you know when you start seeing a war or a changing climate or whatever it is that makes you think, I'm seeing some indication that the end of time is about to come? We have no clue that it's coming. There is no sign. Make sense? No one knows. No angel knows. So if an angel came down and said, I know. If you could talk directly to Jesus, he's going to tell you, I don't know. The Father knows. Now then, let's get 33 to 37. What do we learn from 33 to 37? Yeah, look at verse 33. Take heed, watch and pray, for you don't know when the time is. That's probably the most practical application of the whole study. The destruction of Jerusalem is over. I'm not waiting on that. I didn't live through that. That's history. I'm concerned about the second coming, and I don't know when it's going to come. So what am I going to do about it? I'm going to two things, verse 33, watch and pray. Why? Because I don't know when. Now he gives an illustration. What is his illustration, 34? Man goes off on a journey, that is, to a far country and gave authority to his servants. And because they didn't know when he's coming back, they needed to watch. So you need to watch. He may come back at midnight, may come in the morning, etc. And then notice he concludes at verse 37, I say to you all, watch. Now this is where, for what it's worth to you, Matthew 25 plugs in. See, Mark, remember he writes with speed? He jumps on to the trial. Matthew 26, he skipped all of that discussion about the judgment scene and the talents and etc., the separation of the sheep from the goats. Remember all that? That plugs in right here for what that may be worth to us. I think we're done.